Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we are on a very, very tight schedule today, so I'm just going to give you what's coming up and get on with it. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an interview I did recently with Richard Falk, and it's about the situation facing the Palestinian people as the Zionist regime in Israel has suddenly claimed all of Jerusalem as its own private property. So stay tuned for that one. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing to you the voice of Dar Jamail, and I recently had the opportunity to talk with Dar about how the world is facing a major, major catastrophe in regard to the climate. So check this out. All right, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Dar Jamail. He's written an article recently called The Melting of Antarctica and Other Catastrophic Impacts of Climate Disruption. And Dar is a journalist and author, and he began a recent article in his climate disruption series by observing the signs of runaway anthropogenic climate disruption, ACD, continued to mount with each passing month. And this is an incredibly, if you think at all about it, think about what this is going to mean for the fate of the entire planet, not just humanity, although that's a big concern, but the fate of the entire planet. Dar, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be with you again.
Sure. Well, let's jump in. As I said, one of your most recent articles on the climate is titled Apocalyptic Melting Transpires in Antarctica as Earth Wraps Up a Scorching Year. And you begin it by saying that the signs of anthropogenic climate disruption continue to mount with each passing month. Now, what are you talking about here? Anthropogenic climate disruption, what is it?
That is simply a more scientifically precise wording of climate change or global warming, because given the context of this country with how strong the fossil fuel denial movement is and how well funded it is, those of us reporting on it need to be as precise as possible. So anthropogenic, human cause, and then climate disruption is a much more precise description of what's happening than global warming or climate change, because literally the amount of CO2 that we've introduced into the atmosphere, it isn't just literally causing climate change or global warming, because in some places things are even far colder. It's essentially just throwing the climate into chaos. So climate disruption is just simply a more accurate way to describe what's happening.
Mm-hmm. But when you talk about climate disruption, just so people don't go, oh, I don't have anything to worry about now, really. I mean, what you're talking about, this is a threat to the existence of the planet. You're actually presenting a situation to people that says, look, this is a real threat, and this is something we have to do something about or face the consequences, which could be terrible.
Well, that's right. We're already in the sixth mass extinction. There's now a couple of different peer-reviewed scientific reports published in extremely esteemed journals that show that. That's not news. That's actually old news. Those reports, I think the first of which was published over a year ago now. So we're in the sixth mass extinction. We've triggered it by what we've done to the planet with pollution, deforestation, et cetera, but especially with climate disruption. We've literally changed the composition of the atmosphere and the chemistry of the oceans. And so last year's CO2 increase in the atmosphere that we generated was a 50% increase than the average was over the last decade alone. So we're looking at a situation where we're changing the chemistry and the content of the Arctic Ocean to where it's starting to look more like the Atlantic Ocean. So the food webs are getting completely disrupted. And that's just not in the Arctic, but across the globe. And this year, again, is on track to certainly be within the top three warmest years in history, which basically just means the top three hottest years ever recorded are the last 3 years. And that's the trend that we're on, and that clearly is the trend that we've been on for a while, and certainly looks like one that's not going to stop anytime soon. And so this is just simply stating the facts, and they do sound like being alarmist, because this is what's happening. This forces us to really look at what are our reactions and what are our emotional responses, and are we going to really take this information in and then behave accordingly? But it really means that when we're changing the planet this quickly, that our ability to feed ourselves, not even talking about what this is doing to the other species on the planet, but it's making the planet change to the point where arable land, season changes, temperature extremes, droughts, extreme weather events, et cetera, it's going to make it far, far more difficult to feed people on the planet at the rate at which we're changing things, because simply plants and nature and agriculture can't keep up with the changes that we're imposing on the planet.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's mentioned in a couple of places when you're writing at Truthout, you talk about this could be global mass extinction, and this could be an event that's possible by 2100. And I don't think a lot of people think in those terms. They think, okay, well, what Dar's talking about is something way down the line, and we have the opportunity to reverse some things. But actually, when you look at 2100, that's not all that far in terms of the life of the Earth overall. And when you're talking about the possibility of this kind of mass extinction event beginning by 2100, this is a fairly heavy thing.
It very much is, and it's already started. The sixth mass extinction, we're in it. It's officially begun, as I mentioned. So that's not something that's going to happen far off into the future. There have been other reports that have come out that said, well, it is still something that would possibly start by 2100. Again, I would point to the reports that have already been published that I've cited in previous climate dispatches. But it's a situation where the catastrophic impacts are already upon us. What I'm trying to impress in my articles and in the book that I'm working on now that's going to come out next year with the new press is that there's no more future tense about these worst-case scenarios, that we're in it, we're living in it, this is what it looks like, and it's going to keep amplifying and intensifying because runaway feedback loops are nonlinear. This is not going to be a linear projection. And if you look at the graphs and the visualizations, there's some brilliant ones that have been produced by Climate Central and other groups like that, that literally show these visuals of here's the temperature increase since the advent of the Industrial Revolution. And if you look at literally even just the last few years, they start to go exponential. They start to go nonlinear, whereas before that, there had been sort of a linear progression. And so, again, it doesn't mean that it's going to be some Hollywood version of, oh, all of a sudden tomorrow we wake up and all the animals are dead. But again, if we look at it through the human time frame at which this is unfolding compared to a geologic time frame. I mean, let me give you an example. The worst mass extinction in the history of the planet is the Permian mass extinction 252 million years ago. Over 90% of life on Earth was annihilated. That was caused by, most scientists believe, by a giant volcanic event in the traps in Siberia that over 80,000 years released enough CO2 into the atmosphere to warm the planet enough where the Arctic melted enough and the methane trapped in the permafrost there was released. And then that really kicked it into overdrive, and that was kind of the death knell of that mass extinction event. We're literally replicating that process. We've introduced enough CO2 in the atmosphere already that we've warmed it a little bit more than 1 degree Celsius since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Even the worst case IPCC predictions, which continue to be low ball figures, they're saying we could see as much as just about 5C is their worst case warming scenario by 2100. And look at what's happened to the planet with just 1C. And many of the scientists I've talked to for my book, some of the most esteemed scientists out there, think even 2C is really an unfathomable situation, that people don't really even understand what 2C means for biological diversity on the planet and our ability to sustain ourselves, let alone 3, 4, 5C. And there's some predictions even going up to 12C, which is like, you know, let's just even save our breath talking about that. So we're looking at this unfolding right now. And again, there's scientific reports that come out and verify that just with what we've introduced into the atmosphere right now and raising the temperatures 1C, between 70 and 99% of all glaciers in western British Columbia gone by 2100. So like you said, we're talking about 82 years from now. Same for the Himalaya, between 70 and 90% of all glaciers in the Himalaya, the highest mountain range on the planet, gone by 2100. I mean, there's a long list you can just tick off. No more Arctic sea ice in the summers. Probably that could start happening literally in a year now. We're looking at just the last year alone, the amount of sea ice loss in both the Arctic and the Antarctic volumes are at a minimum in the last year. So just go on down the list and look at all the key indicators, and everything is showing, yes, we are full steam ahead. This is happening at ever accelerating paces, and there's just nothing out there to indicate that it's going to slow down.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dar, one of the things as you were talking, you kept mentioning 1C and 2C, just so people are clear. You know, a lot of times people generally get the concept of, whoa, we could be in trouble, this planet could be in trouble. But actually, there's particular things. And one of the things actually I need people to understand is when you say 2C and 1C, what is that exactly?
Yeah, we throw these around, and I'm sorry, I'm so steeped in this stuff that I kind of forget to give context a lot of the time. And so when we talk about climate disruption and temperature increase and CO2 increase, it's always compared to pre-industrial revolution baseline levels. So we're comparing it to what was going on in the planet temperature-wise and CO2 content before the industrial revolution began and before we began injecting large amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere. So when we say there's been a 1 degree C rise, again, it's a little challenging to talk about it sometimes because some people say, well, since 1850 or since 1900. But when I talk about it, I generally write about it from the perspective of when the Industrial Revolution began. So essentially it means this is how much we've warmed the planet since we started burning fossil fuels. And so that gives you an idea of a time frame. And by that, we generally mean somewhere around, say, 1800 or 1850. Again, it's arguable when the Industrial Revolution exactly began. Some people will say it began with the advent of agriculture, but we're talking about essentially machinery and burning fossil fuels when it comes to climate disruption. So generally around between 1800 and 1850, that's the baseline that we talk about. So we're raising temperatures and CO2 content starting at that baseline.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to run through a couple particulars because I think one of the things that you are really powerful in when you write about this is you do present the overall picture, but then you also present people with some concrete understanding of the particulars that are happening today, the things that actually can be seen. And then there's the question of whether or not these things can be reversed, but the things that people can actually look at as real physical evidence. And I wanted to go through a couple of them because they're really stunning when you think about this. Insects, that was one that really got me. You point out that kind of got you too, like to look at insects and what's happening with insects in relation to what's happening with the climate overall. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, that's right. There was a study, I believe it was the Dispatch before the one that we just published earlier this week, where there was a study in Germany where there's been literally a catastrophic collapse of insect populations in a lot of their nature reserves over there. That's where they carried out the study, upwards of a 75% loss. People think, well, oh, insects, whatever, they're just insects. But we're talking about a large portion of the base of the entire food web. We're talking about things that play a critical role in pollination of food, including our own. And so when we're seeing these abrupt, catastrophic, dramatic decreases of things like insects, of things like the amount of phytoplankton in the oceans, they produce half the oxygen on the planet, along with being the base of the oceanic food chain. And when we've lost now more than half the phytoplankton in the oceans and studies in Germany showing at least in some areas an abrupt 75% loss of insect populations, these are, as you said, they're very, very alarming indicators that we very much need to be paying attention to.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dar Jamail. And Dar is a writer and journalist whose work appears regularly in the website truthout.org. All right, let's move on to trees. People walk around and they'll think, okay, yeah, trees, it's happening, but we can reverse this. It's not that bad. You can go out and plant things and do all these things. But there actually is, one, an importance to the existence of trees, but two, what's happening to them today is really alarming when you put it in the context you put it in, which is an overall worldwide context and what's happening to these forests and their relationship to the ability of the human species and other species to survive.
That's right. And again, this should have been something I mentioned, giving the broad brushstrokes about context of everything and sort of a disclaimer that when we talk about these changes, and I'm bringing this up with trees for a reason, we can't ever attribute everything that's happening to them only to climate disruption. And climate disruption might just be playing a portion of it, or it might be by far and away the biggest factor, but you can never say that one single event is only attributable to climate disruption. And that's, again, just widely understood in the science and certainly those working as journalists covering it. But I just want to put that out there. And so when we talk about trees, you know, intentional deforestation, burning down forests, chopping them down to turn them into fields for agriculture, or just for human encroachment of people wanting to develop land there, put houses there, et cetera. But certainly climate disruption is always a factor, and in some areas it is the leading factor. So forests usually exist in equilibrium with the area where they live and are always exist in that equilibrium. But then when we start ramping up the temperatures and bringing in droughts and there's catastrophic flooding events, that's going to start wiping out forests at an unnatural rate, and that's what we're seeing too. So That coupled with human deforestation, just last year, the total amount of global tree cover loss was an area the same size as the country of New Zealand. So that's a little bit more than 73 million acres, which was a 51% increase over just the previous year. That's according to a recent study I just noted in my last dispatch. And when we talk about losing trees, this is also critical. That's habitat for birds, insects, wildlife. Trees play an extremely, it's almost like the polar bear as far as if you want to save a planet, plant a tree, right? This iconic symbol of the environment, because trees, they sequester carbon. They release clean oxygen into the atmosphere. They store water. Their roots help store more water in the ground, not just for them, but for everything in them, meaning insects, birds, animals, other shrubs, other vegetation in the forest. They play a critical component. And then in mountains, this is why mountains are considered water towers, because trees keep all that moisture in the mountains. They keep the soils moist. They help store water. They shade snowpack. Snowpack can last longer. And all of that, of course, benefits us living downstream of all of that. Entire ecosystems are reliant upon trees. And so when we're wiping out trees at this staggering rate, again, this is an extremely alarming situation that people need to really pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you keep talking about, and it's kind of a contradiction here when you look at, like, okay, we're talking about the heat and a baking planet. At the same time, you're pointing out these almost apocalyptic rainfall events and rising sea levels. How do those two things come together?
That's a really good point. And that's where, again, when we use climate disruption instead of just global warming, because global warming kind of makes it sound more linear, whereas disruption means more chaos. And so the water realm is really where the kind of the chaos comes to the fore. So when we warm the atmosphere, it can hold more moisture. And so that's one of the key factors as to why we're having such incredible rain events, like what happened with Hurricane Harvey down in Houston this past summer. By far, the single largest rainfall event in the history of this country. We have these catastrophic floods. And then because of heat and because of shifting weather patterns and disrupted weather patterns, we'll have these long extended droughts. Like, for example, I live up on the Olympic Peninsula. There's literally temperate rainforest out here in Olympic National Park. And 2 or 3 years ago, we had a severe drought in a couple of the rainforests here, and even wildfires in one of the rainforests here. And this is in an area that typically pre-climate disruption would get 200 plus inches of rainfall in 1 year. And so it's caused this tremendous imbalance where you have the heat, for example. I kind of alluded to this talking about the trees. It's melting out glaciers and snowpack in the mountains faster and sooner. So then with the advent of earlier and warmer springs, all that water is released. We have floods happening downriver of that are certainly out of the bounds of normal record keeping, meaning breaking records. And then, of course, that snowpack's gone, and then that leads to these intense droughts through the summers that we're becoming very acquainted with out here on the West Coast and the general Western U.S. from Colorado on out our direction. And then, of course, by the end of the summer, we have these extreme droughts persisting, and look at what's happening in California as we speak. Here we are in the middle of December almost, and we have these incredible wildfires down in Southern California. And it kind of reminds me back when Schwarzenegger was governor of California, and here's this Republican governor saying, look, there's no longer a fire season in California. Fire season is year-round. Well, it looks like he was right. And that's just one example of when we mess with the climate system of the planet as we have, everything gets completely out of balance, and then we're left with these extremes between flooding and droughts, between extreme highs and extreme cold temperatures. And you throw all that into the mix, and this is why we're seeing these catastrophic losses of insects and tree cover and things that are critical components of the basis of the food chain.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've been talking about the things that are happening and how they fall out and how they come about. And one of the things is ocean acidity and sea life. You know, ocean acidity is not something that people just normally go to. You know, you think I grew up on the East Coast, you know, we used to go swimming in the Atlantic Ocean. It was, you know, salt water was different than going down to the river or whatever. And you just had it was there. Now you're talking about ocean acidity, and it could have catastrophic meaning for all of humanity and every other creature.
That's right. And another reason to pay attention to this is because that was essentially the key factor in the Permian mass extinction that we talked about at the beginning of the show, that it was ocean acidification that was the prime driver of that extinction event. I mean, once the planet was warmed, it was the acidification. And so essentially what acidification is, the broad brushstroke explanation is that when we introduce as much CO2 content into the atmosphere as we have, which is now 130 parts per million greater than it ever was prior to the advent of the of industry and us burning fossil fuels, then a huge amount of that CO2 is going to be absorbed into the oceans. And then that literally is changing the chemistry of the oceans and causing them to become more acidic. And so obviously that's going to affect sea life and have huge impacts on coral. So anything with a calcium shell, you know, a calcium shell like crabs and shrimp and sea life such as this, as well as coral and its ability to continue to exist. And so it's going to have obvious detrimental impacts on all those organisms, and it already has. And so certainly out here in the Northwest, we're seeing big problems with mussels. Other areas are seeing issues with oysters and you know, just different types of shellfish having big problems now trying to live in this new environment. And so it's having those kinds of impacts. And then, of course, all of those then spread out across the natural food webs of the ocean. And again, we're being impacted. And so when you start to see seafood prices on items like I just mentioned start to increase, it's because it's getting harvests are getting smaller. In some years, it's getting harder and harder to find enough of them to kind of keep those markets in equilibrium.
You talk about a reality check, and that people really need to have a reality check, and that being that the dominant cause of anthropogenic climate disruption is, in fact, human activity. And I wanted you to talk about that, and particularly let's talk about it in relation to, and we can explore this in depth, the denial and reality question and Trump and what he's done in relation to all this.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, I always conclude my dispatches with that denial and reality section. And the denial section, I mean, I could do dispatches only on denial, given the Trump administration and that he's populated it with the huge parts of his administration with these advocates of the fossil fuel industry, you know, like Scott Pruitt heading, you know, a guy who was former attorney general of Oklahoma and who had sued the EPA numerous times and extremely pro-fact fracking and pro-fossil fuel as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. It would be funny if the consequences weren't so dire. And literally, scientists are being prevented from going to conferences to give talks if they are going to be talking about climate disruption. They're scrubbing government websites of the words climate change and global warming, literally scrubbing them. You know, and this happening with the Department of Interior, the Environmental Protection Agency, and several other places, you know, the National Institutes of Health, you know, all these government websites are being scrubbed and budgets cut, research being cut, and scientists being prevented from doing their jobs. And it's an extremely worrisome situation. And it's really a worst case scenario in a sense, because here we are at this time where if we were going to have any hope, not stopping climate disruption, that went out the window a long time ago, but doing something to seriously try to mitigate the impacts, meaning if we made some dramatic changes on a global level with governments coordinating the actions, maybe we could mitigate it. Maybe we could keep from getting into some of the higher ends of the worst case predictions. I think we're already locked into the worst case predictions, but maybe we could sort of take the edge off. And instead, we've got this maniac, lunatic administration that is just stomping on the gas accelerator across the board. And that's, you know, the last thing we need to be doing right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked about, actually, I found this very interesting, too. You actually cited this development with 1,500 scientists who issued recently a catastrophic warning to humanity about all this. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Right. And actually, it was 15,000 scientists, and they wrote what they called a letter to humanity, basically calling it a warning to humanity and citing that this is it came from the Union of Concerned Scientists, and basically talking about the fact that if we don't get our act together immediately and promptly and start having that widespread, globally coordinated actions that I was just talking about, then it's going to be too late to really change our course from basically wiping ourselves out. And they don't put it that dramatically, but they say, look, we're on this, they call it a failing trajectory that we're on, and time is running out. And that, they talk about the fact that, stating the obvious, Earth is our only home, and that we are making it an unlivable place. And without immediate dramatic changes, it's going to be too late to do anything. And that just came out within the last month, signed by 15,000 different scientists, and saying, look, we've given this notice before. Back in the late 90s, the Union for Concerned Scientists did a similar thing, and now they've issued an even more dire warning.
Mm-hmm. And Dar, that's one of the reasons why you have to keep writing like this, man, and keep getting it out to people. And you and I are going to have to keep on talking. I want to thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Thanks again, Michael. Appreciate
sure,
it.
Definitely. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Times, tales from the dark side, evidence of the settlements on my hard drive. Man, I swear my heart died at the end of that car ride when I saw that checkpoint.
All right, that was Jasiri X with Checkpoint. Now, I'm very pleased to be moving on to our next segment, and that is a conversation I had recently with Richard Falk. Richard is the former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. He is also a professor emeritus of international law at Princeton University, and he has been teaching at UC Santa Barbara. All right, Richard, I wanted to talk to you about this first question because it's come up really hard-hitting in the last week or so. Trump's announcement that the U.S. is going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and is going to move its diplomatic embassy to the city of Jerusalem. Now, he's justified this by saying that Israel is the only country in the world that is not allowed to locate its capital in a national city of its own choice. What's the problem here, Richard?
Well, there are a number of problems. For one thing, there's an international consensus that Trump's announcement broke to the effect that no change in the status of Jerusalem would be made until the parties themselves, in other words, Israel and Palestine, reached an agreement as to how they would share control over the city. And that was understood to be something that would be deferred until the last stages of a supposed peace negotiation. So that's one aspect of what's wrong and disruptive about it. The other is the fact that Israel is trying to establish a capital in an occupied territory is basically not its own territory. The assumption being made by the Israeli assertion is that Jerusalem as a totality is part of Israel. But the whole international law understanding of the status of Jerusalem is that it is not resolved as to its proper legal status, and in the interim, it's occupied territory, at least so far as East Jerusalem is concerned. And the whole of Jerusalem is in a kind of legal abeyance. So you have two big problems there.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about this, I kept thinking, well, okay, but there's this relationship, or what is the relationship between this and what you're saying and the fact that Israel has no problem at all making this move that it decided to make and that they did it years ago. They actually, decades ago, stated their intention to actually make the capital Jerusalem. But now there's this whole thing that's developed where they have the sanction of the big dog in the world, the U.S. imperialists. And there's this whole question of the relationship between what they've decided to do and the fact that Israel has no problem doing it, since it actually has refused. I mean, it's actually refused to define its borders. It's probably the only country in the world that has refused to define its borders in all these decades.
Yes, exactly, because there's the tension between Israel as a established political entity, and the ambitions of Israel to satisfy the maximal Zionist vision of biblical Israel, which extends at least to the West Bank and the whole of Jerusalem. So there's always been that tension, and Israel has cleverly avoided committing itself publicly to this vision of a greater Israel, which is a direct confrontation with the international consensus, and to the establishment of its own legitimacy back in 1948, when it was accepted as an independent state on the basis of General Assembly Resolution 181, which was a division of the territory of mandated Palestine between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and even at that time was considered by the Arab world and certainly by the Palestinians to be a highly unfair territorial allocation.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to ask you a little bit more about 181 soon, but I wanted to follow up on this a little bit, because part of the thing that I see around this, or that I, as I was reading it and studying it, I kept thinking, well, wait a minute, you know, they've refused to define their borders for purposes of international law. And it's sort of like they've basically said, all right, to hell with this. We don't have to pay attention to what's going on in relation to, you know, what international law is. And they do have a sort of a history of saying international law, screw that. Doesn't apply to us. And it's also tied
well,
in.
Well, screw that, except, Michael, when it's on our side.
Right. Go ahead, speak to that.
In other words, Israel can be very legalistic if they think law favors their position or what they're advocating, and they constantly are asserting the kind of legal arguments to justify, for instance, their attacks on Gaza and their claims of self-defense, which are factually very vulnerable to criticism, but at least rest on a coherent legal argument. So they use law very opportunistically, much like the U.S. itself. But going back to your earlier point, the way in which Israel has been able to project its effective control over Jerusalem is a geopolitical one, in which it was content with U.S. ambiguity, that it would support Israel in terms of its own extension of control, but until Trump, it would adhere to the international consensus that the legal future and political future of Jerusalem would be determined by negotiations, by diplomacy, between the two parties. And why this decision is seen as a rupture and a repudiation of this long-standing international understanding is that it looks like a way of affirming Israel's determination to have an end game to the conflict imposed by its unilateral edict or decree. In other words, to abandon diplomacy and not even pretend that it's interested in a negotiated solution.
Yeah, and that leads me into this question, because I remember speaking to you over the years and reading things that you've written and then studying the situation in general. There is this particular importance in relation to the West Bank and how Israel views that. And it's very much, and it's also true, I guess you'd have to say about Gaza too, when you look at the seemingly never-ending attacks on Gaza, that it's very much bordering on the denial of the existence of Palestine and the Palestinian people, Palestine as a legitimate state, and the Palestinian people as a legitimate people.
No question. I mean, that's the from the very beginning, see, it's not really the puzzle. Challenging Zionism was, how do we get rid of the Palestinian majority? Remembering that when the Balfour Declaration 100 years ago was issued, the Jewish population of Palestine was no more than 6% at the most. And even at the end of World War II, when the partition resolution was adopted, the Jewish population of Palestine was only 33%. And to make Israel fulfill the Zionist vision of a democratic and Jewish state meant they had to establish a Jewish majority. And the only way they could do that was to get rid of the most of the Palestinians. And the so-called Nakba, or dispossession of the Palestinians that occurred in the 1947-48 war, achieved that result. But it's been a continuous process of how do we deal with this demographic so-called ticking bomb without repudiating our legitimacy claims that rest on being a liberal democracy. And increasingly, as they move toward this unilateral end of the conflict, they've abandoned any serious claim of being a democratic state as distinct from a kind of ethnocratic state. It's clearly intended to be a Jewish state, and the idea of democracy and human rights is definitely subordinated, and that's why we concluded in our UN study that Israel's structure of control over the Palestinian people as a whole really rested on apartheid structures of victimization and subjugation based on ethnic identity.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that, and I spent a lot of time studying apartheid in South Africa and had written about it, had gone there when it was an apartheid state and interviewed all kinds of people about the situation. And one of the things that's struck me, though, is in terms of, like I was just thinking as you're talking about, you know, this point about what, how Israel has reacted to or acted upon the Palestinian people. It's true that there's a lot in common there, which we should talk about now, I guess, actually, the point about you've talked about apartheid in South Africa and how it applies to Israel and the Palestinian people. But I also think that there is this element of, I mean, it's sort of like ethnic cleansing in a certain sense that they've done with the Palestinian people, where they don't need the Palestinian people and they don't really want them. And so this whole thing has been unleashed.
And they've struck, and in that sense, it's very different because the South African economy was premised on cheap African labor.
Mm-hmm.
Israel has deliberately not wanted to base its economic viability on Palestinian labor for precisely the reasons you suggest, that they want to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible. And ethnic cleansing is the gentlest accurate word for what happened in 1947-48, which meant the expulsion of 700,000 to 750,000 Palestinians and the denial of any right of return, regardless of how deep the connections of the Palestinians were with the land and with family and other connections.
Yeah, and that leads to something, too, though, that, which is really, I mean, it's really important in terms of people understanding this, because then all of a sudden, and what you've pointed to this as and you started to speak to it a little bit earlier, but you've pointed to it in other places as well. You've pointed to the importance of actually people going into history to understand the violation that Israel and in some ways the U.S. is carrying out in relation to or in this new recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, that there's much more happening there than simply and it is interesting because there's a certain bowing down to the Christian fascists in this country, you know, sort of personified by Pence and all the people that's sort of wide-eyed and happy they were to find out that this was going to happen, that Jerusalem, the capital, was going to be in Jerusalem. You know, but you've also got this whole...
Yeah, that's a very good point, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then you've also got this whole thing about what they've done where the, you know, where in terms of this new recognition of Jerusalem as the capital, that you've compared it to General Assembly Resolution 181 from the United Nations, and I thought that was actually really important for people to talk about. So maybe we could hit on both of those points.
Yes, well, see, one of the things that's interesting about this decision is that it joins the kind of unilateralist foreign policy that Trump champions, which was epitomized perhaps by the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Change Agreement, being the only country of 193 that repudiates this seminal experiment in international cooperation to solve a common global problem. So you have on the one side this unilateralism, ignoring international cooperative arrangements and structures, and on the other hand, you have this double policy domestically, satisfying Zionist donors like Sheldon Adelson and satisfying Christian evangelists like Mike Pence, and at the same time serving the interests of class-based politics associated with Wall Street and the financial world. These two domestic and international vectors of Trump's policy converge in this Jerusalem issue.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Richard Falk. Richard is a former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. He's also an American Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University. Now, how does this General Assembly Resolution 181 fit into things? Because that actually, it seems fairly important to understand that, what it is and how it fits into this whole scenario.
Well, it fits in, again, in at least two ways. One is that Israel's own legitimacy as a state is premised on the partition resolution that was adopted in 1947 and served as the basis of Israel's admission to the UN a year later. And secondly, it disposes of Jerusalem as belonging to neither Jews nor the non-Jewish communities in Palestine, but as an internationalized city under UN administration. And the notion here was that this particular city with its religious symbolism and so on should not be part of the partition arrangement. So there was, in a sense, a territorial denial in the very foundation of Israel's own legitimacy from a UN point of view that took place as soon as Israel in 1967 took over the whole of Jerusalem militarily and immediately doubled its area by Israeli law, and then declared it to be the unified eternal city of the Jewish people.
Boy, tell me this.
So 181 is very, very fundamental, I think, to a correct understanding of the evolution of the conflict and relation to Jerusalem as a particular place.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's actually what I was thinking as when I started to speak there, is that it is very much part of that. And when you see that, you know, in terms of including what you were talking about, just what the resolution actually said, but then you actually have to talk about this new development. And in some ways it is a new development, and in some ways it isn't, where you have Israel has been pretty open about what it's doing today in relation to Jerusalem. And that actually even went back to 1980, where they actually were pretty open about, look, this is going to be our capital city. You don't like it. Tough.
Yes, but they were saying that, but even the U.S. refused to endorse that. See, and what's different now is that the Trump diplomacy, such as it is an unconditional endorsement of what Israel was unilaterally proclaiming ever since 1967, essentially.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get into with you. I really wanted to hear your thoughts on that, because it does seem like, you know, look, the U.S. Congress, I mean, they even passed an act that, what was it, the Jerusalem Embassy Act. If, you know, people were just thinking about it now, but actually the U.S. Congress in the 90s passed this, the Jerusalem Embassy Act, which basically recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital back then.
Yes, and that's another interesting dimension of all of this, that the Congress was basically playing domestic politics, because they didn't try to tie the executive's hand, and they always connected it to U.S. security and other considerations. But they wanted at the same time to please the Zionist and pro-Israeli lobby and so on. And this was a good symbolic way of doing that without paying any cost. And it shows domestically how much the Palestinians have suffered because they had no countervailing power to the Israeli well-organized and well-funded lobbies. And you get a very distorted policy, national policies, whenever you have that kind of one-sidedness on the domestic political scene, and an issue is very fundamental for an influential ethnic or religious group within American society.
What do you mean by that one-sidedness?
Well, what I mean is that you have no, for instance, in the relationship to Greek wishes with respect to the Aegean, there was always, or with Cyprus is a better example, Greek aspirations with regard to Cyprus were always balanced by U.S. concerns about NATO and preserving a positive relationship with Turkey. And so even though it's the domestic scene was favorable to the Greek pressures, they were always neutralized by this strategic interest in keeping Turkey from being too unhappy. Same thing with the Armenian issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this. You said, and I'm trying to really figure this out because I know that there's all this, you know, you've spent a lot of your life actually digging into this and really speaking out in ways that were extremely important in exposing this. And international law, I read somewhere where international law says that East Jerusalem is occupied territory. And therefore,
yes,
whatever is done in relation to it is subject to the Fourth Geneva Convention. But it appears that it's not really, you know, that doesn't seem to matter anything to anybody.
Well, what you're really saying indirectly is that geopolitics trumps, and that's a bad...
It's good.
bad pun, trumps international humanitarian law. And that when there's a sufficiently strong geopolitical move, the U.S. and other countries push international law to one side, and that happens particularly in relation to security issues and war peace issues. Doesn't happen so much in commercial trade investment issues or maritime safety and a whole series of things where international law works pretty well. It doesn't work well where hard power is part of the nexus of the problem or the core of the problem. And that's been the case in all of these territorial conflicts. And the Zionist movement and Israel as a state has been very opportunistic in the way in which it's disguised its real goals and pursued them stage by stage. You know, going back again to the Balfour Declaration, where they were only aspiring to achieve a homeland within the established entity of Palestine, of which they were a small minority, as I said earlier, to then wanting to be a state in accordance with the partition conception, to then wanting to be a state that could encroach upon the occupied Palestinian territory and become a state that was larger than what was envisioned either by partition or by the end of the so-called War of Independence in 1948. So at every stage, Israel has escalated its real demands beyond what its public posture had been at an earlier stage.
Mm-hmm. And tell me this.
And that makes it extremely difficult for the ordinary person to understand the progression and escalation of Israeli ambitions because they weren't publicly visible. The full extent of them were not publicly visible until very recently. And now with the green light given by the Trump administration, they've become more and more visible.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Now, tell me this. You know, there's a point here that this idea, I guess, that it poses a question, that, and I think you've posed this question yourself, that does any state actually really have the right to establish its capital in a city that's occupied or in a territory that's occupied, that is actually occupied, is not, you know, and is recognized as occupied, you know, across the world and through the bitter experience of the people who live there?
The short answer to the first question is, of course not. Imagine if East Germany or the Soviet Union had extended Berlin to include a significant part of West Berlin, there would be World War III.
Mm-hmm.
See, and they were both occupied portions of a once unified and again now unified city. But the whole notion of occupation is incompatible with claiming territorial rights in that political entity that is, by international understanding, occupied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And by being occupied means it's not subject to sovereign control. And to have a capital city presupposes complete sovereign control. You've never heard of a capital in a place where the sovereign government didn't have plenary legal, political, and cultural control.
Yeah, right. Right, exactly. Good point. Yeah. Well, tell me this, because, and this is related to that. So then out of this situation, there actually has been a campaign that's kind of going on over the years to not just verbally, and I know this is something you've really delved into, but to not just verbally, but physically do away with the Palestinian population in whatever means was necessary.
Yeah, but do away has been somewhat ambiguously implemented and may mean different things to different strands of the Israeli leadership. One meaning of do away is to effectively subjugate, whether the Palestinians are treated as a minority, discriminated minority in Israel, or as a captive population in Gaza, or as an insecure residence of Jerusalem, or as a occupied West Bank, or as permanent consignment to refugee or involuntary exile status. So one whole sense of what it means to get rid of the Palestinians is to subjugate and effectively control. The other, which is overlaps with this, is to seek to avoid a demographic ambiguity by the growth of Palestinian population, by actually physically getting rid of Palestinians to the extent possible. And one of the ways this is currently being considered within Israel is to somehow get rid of Gaza as part of the Palestinian entity and persuade either Egypt or Jordan to absorb and administer Gaza either as part of their own territory or as some sort of protectorate within their territory. This effort has so far failed, but it's indicative of this effort to combine, on the one side, ethnic cleansing with, on the other side, complete subjugation.
Yeah, and I think you just answered the last question I was going to ask you, which was where do things stand now in the wake of the Trump machine and what it's doing? And I think this point about, look, it's a very bad situation for the Palestinian people. It's a very bad situation for people all around the world who, if we allow that to happen, if we allow what they're doing to happen, if there's not a massive wave of opposition to this, both inside Israel, inside the, you know, the Palestinian territories, all of this, and inside here, where actually, you know, that Trump is actually the first president to actually not talk about the, you know, doing this, but to actually do it, and what it means in terms of the world. It's a terrible escalation of the rule of U.S. imperialism around the world and the suffering of people in, you know, in Palestine, the Palestinian people, but also what it means to people all over the world we lose some of our own humanity if we stand there and just allow yet another genocidal assault to go on.
No, I completely agree with you, Michael. I mean, it's a precedent for that precisely that kind of unilateral geopolitical militarism or iron fist geopolitics, where law and morality are completely marginalized, and a bunch of calculations have been made. See, one, I think two of the things that are different in the Trump presidency is, first of all, intensifying these dysfunctional special relationships that pre-existed Trump with Israel and Saudi Arabia. And secondly, this pandering in an even more extreme way to the major Israeli donors within the United States and the Christian Zionists who have somehow wrapped up their own expectations of the second coming of Jesus with the transcendence of Israel as a renewed biblical state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Richard, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, as ever, I enjoyed it, Michael, and your questions led to a very good conversation.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed talking with you, man. And we'll do it again soon, all right?
Great.
All right, Richard,
take care.
You too, man. Bye now.
Bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Richard Falk. Richard is the former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. He's also an American professor emeritus of international law at Princeton University, and he's also held a position at UC Santa Barbara. And we've been talking with Richard about what's the significance of Trump's announcement that the U.S. will now recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. What does it mean for the Palestinian people? All right, we're running up on our time, so I want to be real quick with this, but I want to make sure that I thank everyone that helped make this show possible today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op, Teddy Robinson, and all of you who tune in each and every week and stay tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going out with something that back when I was a kid really made me think, and today has even more pressing importance than ever. And that is Eve of Destruction, but this is by Public Enemy. Talk to you again next week.